From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's interesting, fun, and if we can understand it well, so will you. I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
When was the last time you tried to change somebody's mind? How did it go? And when was the last time you changed your mind? In an age characterized by social media and partisan politics, we see heated yet unproductive disagreements over issues with real consequences. From COVID-19 to abortion to climate change, our next guest this morning is David McGraney, who has written How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. We look forward to our conversation with David.
Our second guest this morning is National Geographic Explorer and Director of the Tree Foundation, Dr. Meg Lohman, a.k.a. Canopy Meg, the world's first global arbonaut, which is a treetop explorer. She'll tell us about the 2023 National Geo Kids Almanac. The almanac features animal stories, weird but true facts, and interviews with National Geographic explorers.
These two guests when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Our guest is David McGraney. He's just written How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. McGraney's book offers practical guidance about techniques to persuade others, whether it's just one person or if it's changing a million people's minds. And ultimately, the book forces us to turn the lens inward and question our own values and beliefs. David, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, we're very happy to have you here. We enjoyed your book. And, you know, I wanted to ask you that the book is well researched and you've even met with cult members, conspiracy theorists, and political activists. How do you approach a conversation with a flat earther?
Oh, wow. Flat earthers are unique, and I love flat earthers because they're nice and neutral. We can talk about them, but anything we learn about that or we discuss can be applied anywhere. With a flat earther, you've got someone who, at first, it feels like you disagree about the facts of the matter, but we know that they also have an ER at the end of their name. Flat earthers suggest they're part of a community, and all the psychological research suggests once you have developed a group identity that you're going to pursue belonging goals over accuracy goals most of the time, but you may not be aware that that's what's happening. So you would want to, instead of having a battle of facts with that person, you'd want to investigate how they arrive at their level of certainty about those facts. So you just ask for a claim. You ask for a very specific claim and something within that the flat earth sort of ideology, the structure of that concept, and ask, could you tell me, before you do anything, you need to develop rapport. You need to make sure you're in a trustworthy environment with the person. Be open, be transparent, be compassionate. Make sure that you're letting them know you just want to understand where they're coming from and you're not attempting to put your beliefs into their model. Then you ask for a claim and then you say, okay, from like 0 to 10, how confident are you in this claim you just produced? And then this can be used on any topic with anyone about anything. Ask for that level of certainty and whatever number they give you, then ask, why does that number feel right to you? And that takes you completely out of the debate frame and into a new place where you're going to be investigating a person's reasoning. And that's actually all you have to do now is hold space for that and say, you know, if they say they're a 7, ask, after they tell you why that's right for them, ask, why not a 10? Why not a 3? Then keep that conversation in that space. As magical and weird as it sounds, just doing that sort of thing where you're opening up that space is very similar to therapeutic models like motivational interviewing. People usually move a little bit, and that builds a momentum toward movement in the future. And also, if you do it well, if you're being honest and nice and approachable, you could also have many more conversations in the future. So that's my quick answer to all that.
Well, I think that's very reasonable, and it certainly makes sense. I am thinking about a friend of mine who, and despite my trying to be reasonable and to not be aggressive or anything, they get defensive very, very quickly. And if I were to ask the question, you know, on a 1 to 10, how strongly do you feel about that? you're insulting me. You know, I mean, you know, they get pretty excited about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And there are people, I mean, I'd love to have more conversations and less debates, more reasonable exchanges, you know, courtesy, respect, those sorts of things. Some people are not wired for that type of thing. How do we talk to them?
I don't think anybody's not wired for it. I think that, that people are motivated to behave in that way. And there's some reason why they're behaving that way. There's something more at play. And so that just means you need to move the conversation to that before you move it to the topic at hand. Like, where is this coming from? Where's this resistance coming from at a base level? For many people, it's a history of conflict with that person, which means they haven't reached that level of trust where they can have that kind of conversation. However, there are other people who they're experiencing something in their lives where they are feeling invalidated and challenged by other people. And they're seeing you as, oh no, here comes another person like everybody else. So in that space, now we can switch the topic to, I'm wondering how you feel about having conversations like this. And now we can talk about that. And so you're now attempting to change their mind about the fact that it's not okay to have conversations like this. It's not okay to give me a number scale or something. There's some nature and nurture in there too. There's evidence to suggest that there's a spectrum of personality types, that there's a certain type of brain that loves learning they're wrong about stuff, loves reading books and listening to podcasts, going to websites just for the sake of going, oh, that was a misconception this whole time. And then they tell other people about it and it feels good. Like it feels nice. They call it scientific curiosity. I don't really like that term because it seems like it makes people feel like it's something to do with lab coats, but it's an openness to some sort of openness to experience is in there. And there are people, if it's a spectrum, there are people who'd be far along the other side, but it's all about trying to protect yourself. It's about, you don't want to be seen as foolish. You don't want to be seen as a person who holds bad beliefs and doesn't think carefully. And the suggestion that you might be wrong makes a person feel like they're about to be shamed for having a certain thought, feeling, or behavior. So you need to do everything you can to take that off the table. Don't say anything or do anything or be a certain way around them that they could interpret as an attempt to shame them.
And David, I have to tell you that I was so pleased to hear that you had a podcast after your Not So Smart book and You Are Now Less Dumb. I have to say, we talked to you years ago on those books, and I've ever since had them sitting on the back of my toilet.
Oh, so wow.
It's a good thing to make it to the back of my toilet. That's great. It means that you want to have a book ever present.
That's great. That is a high honor.
That's quite a compliment.
Yes. I made it to the back of the toilet. I'll put that as a blurb on the next book.
Yeah, you'll want this book on the back of your toilet. Okay, so you start off with this book, and I just have to hear this story. You grew up in Mississippi in the Bible Belt, and you at a young age maybe didn't buy into some of the beliefs held with heels dug in a lot of that community. And yet you were very skeptical that that most people would change their minds about those beliefs. Can you kind of tell us that story? It sets the stage for the book.
Sure. I have to credit Trish Daly, my editor, for saying, I had talked about this with her and she said, why aren't you putting that in the book? And I was like, oh, wow, that's very vulnerable. But she said, I think it should go in there. And I did. I grew up in South Mississippi, Bible Belt. I'm in that Gen X group of people that had all this exposure to people in other places through media who did not seem to see the world the way everybody around us saw it. And we could feel that our values were better expressed somewhere else than where we were at. And there was always that conflict. And there was change taking place around us, and we could see change taking place around the world. But in my own life, I had LGBTQ friends, but I also had an uncle who was closeted. And there's a specific kind of super closeted you have to deal with in an environment where you could maybe suffer great bodily injury, you know? And he had saved up enough money from being a paramedic that he bought a florist in the middle of our very small town. And my first job in life was delivering flowers for that florist. And I'm getting teary eyed thinking about this. Here we go. I was a young man and he called my dad and said, that the landlord was threatening him, was actually being physically violent. And my dad just said, come with me. And he grabbed his keys and we just jumped in the truck, drove straight there. My dad immediately got out of the car, walked straight into the middle of it, was equally violent, and said, you know, never treat my brother like this ever again. And that was that. It was like that's how things get handled in that part of the world. And he got back in the car. He didn't say anything on the way back. He never said a word to anybody in the family. And he didn't ask me to hold my silence because I knew I had to. I knew because he wasn't out to the family. And it was an immediate, I mean, I still think about it, about how my dad seemed to be expressing these same views, but also didn't at the same time. And I realized that there was something about the taboos that you had to pick and choose when you would show where you, how you thought and felt about certain issues. And that was an example of this is a time. And I start the book with that.
Yeah. And then also, you know, you examine, you have this inquiry into the LGBTQ movement, same sex marriage, and you say how it sort of fascinates you because 1 year, most people are opposed mm-hmm. to same sex marriage. And the very next year, the law is created allowing a pathway for same-sex marriage.
At that point in time in my life, I was running the Facebook page for a television station, and it was like all anybody wanted to argue about. It was the way, like today it's gun control, you know, this would be a different thing tomorrow. For a period of time in the United States, it's hard to believe now, people argued every day about same-sex marriage as if it was as like one of these wedge issues. And the arguments were just as angry, just as going nowhere. And there were articles like in the New York Times, this is something that you will never be able to change anybody's mind about this. And then it's felt like if you weren't part of the activism, it felt like it happened overnight. The majority of the country, the polling really shows, went from against to for over the course of a few years, over a decade total, but the flip happened in a few years. And from my end of things, the arguments evaporated. They just went whoosh, and they were gone. And I was like, well, what was that about? Like, we were just arguing this and now we're not. And I started, the way I got into wanting to write this book was I imagine if you took the majority of those people and you put them in a time machine and sent them back 10 years ago, they'd argue with themselves. And I want to know what happened in their brain what actually happened to the level of neurons. And if I could understand that, could I go up a level? What happened in families? What happened in groups? What happened in institutions? How does an entire nation change its mind so quickly? There has to be something happening at the level of brains. And that's how the investigation started.
And it did happen overnight. And we have some serious issues in front of us now. And I love to point to that, about how quickly that changed and about how people really came together. And it was just fascinating. To your question, when we change our minds, or when we dig our feet in and we don't change our minds, what actually happens inside our brains?
Well, brains change via two processes called assimilation and accommodation. Assimilation is when you take something that's novel or ambiguous or uncertain, and you try to make sense of it, you try to make it certain, you try to disambiguate it by seeing it as confirmation of something you already understand, just seeing it as another example of the world that you were expecting to see. Whereas accommodation is when something happens that challenges your preconceived notions and you need to accommodate in some way, and you change your mind to accommodate it. The easiest way to describe that would be like when a child sees a dog for the first time and you point and say dog, and they're like, okay, non-human, four legs, furry dog. Then they see a horse and they go, look, big dog. And you're like, no. So they're trying to assimilate. They're saying it's non-human, four legs, furry. This is, you told me these were dogs. And like, no, that's a horse. They have to accommodate. They have to create a new category, which would be like creatures or animals, in which both dogs and horses exist. That's accommodation. So we're doing that constantly at all times, assimilating and accommodating. Even in this conversation, we're doing that. But at some point, that model becomes so complex and robust that we start walking this tightrope. And the tightrope is, on one side, if you change your mind when you shouldn't, you will become wrong, which could be dangerous. Or if you don't change your mind when you should, you could stay wrong, which is also dangerous. But at some point, you've gotten this far and it's so complex, you tend to favor not changing it until you have to. And so that's why we always resist some change. at a base level, it's somewhere around 30% of the information coming in has to challenge us before we'll feel like we might be wrong about something. But that's base level in a very neutral environment. You add other motivations, like this could put me at risk of losing my job. This could put me at risk of losing my reputation. This could put me at risk of being ostracized by my social group. There are all sorts of social reasons, identity-based reasons, and other vast motivations that could lead that, put that number higher and higher and higher. So depending on the issue, depending on the person, depending on the context, you may face someone who's, it's just not going to work with facts alone. You're going to have to get out of that frame and then move into a more, okay, why is it that you are justifying this? How did you arrive at that level of confidence on this particular thing? Why is this evidence? Why do you interpret it this way and I don't? That's the only way once a person is at a very high level of resistance. You just have to bypass that because you're not going to ever produce enough counter information for them to feel that feeling. For some issues, you can. For some issues, you're going to have to try something a little different.
What is the biggest challenge to communication? Is it the tribe type mentality where we're set with a group? Is it a belief that you can have your own facts and that facts don't matter anymore? You can, you know, that sort of thing. What is the biggest problem out there in effective communication?
Right now it's trust, but this is a phase like everything else. The information ecosystem has become so complex that the gatekeepers have sort of left the building. We're all out on our own now. Researcher Kate Starberg told me it's almost like what happens after a hurricane or a tornado or a fire or a flood. In that kind of environment, everybody's got a lot of high anxiety, but you're not sure who to trust, where the good information is coming from. And so people start modulating their trust based off of different things. They modulate their trust based off of their values. They modulate it based off their attitudes. And, you know, I've lived through a couple of hurricanes and tornadoes, the very first thing you do is you just start trading in rumors. Rumors become really valuable in that environment. You're like, I heard this. Well, so-and-so told me that. And then you start asking, well, who told you that? And like, oh, well, my brother-in-law told me that. Like, your brother-in-law. Okay, well. And you kind of take it a little bit with a little grain of salt. Or you say, oh, yeah, well, firefighters came through here a minute ago and they told me this. You're like, oh, okay. So you're modulating based off trust. We're currently in a social environment, and this won't last, but this happens every once in a while as we move through to the space and time and social change. We're in that sort of the space that's similar to that, this sort of crisis feeling where we're not sure which institutions are the most trustworthy institutions, which news source is the most trustworthy. And we have a lot of anxiety. Everything seems to be like the whole fate of the nation is at stake. And in that place, in that rumor world, we start doing a lot of, where did you hear that? Where did that come from? And if you tell me it came from a source that doesn't match my attitudes and values, I'll be like, well, I don't know about that. And that's where we are. It's not something that we can't fix. We will fix it. We must fix it. But we do have to live through this phase, unfortunately. I am optimistic about what comes next, but it will be at least a generation of this, I think.
David, what would you say about the generation of outrage? It seems to me when I sort of think about the news and maybe the alternative facts, you know, sector of the news, it's really trying to establish outrage in the listening audience. And I see how, say a QAnon, someone who's into QAnon, mm-hmm. and believing that whole pedophilia thing about some of our Democratic or leaders and celebrities and things like that. Like, yeah. If you believe that, of course it's outrageous. Of course that's the most horrible thing. Is that why it's so successful that we just hook into this outrage?
I think it's mostly performative. And I think even the anger is performative. I don't think it's really what I would consider. It's not coming from an honest place. I guess it is honest. It's honest in that you can't help do it. But it's driven by belonging. It's driven by a lot of the institutions we depended on in previous generations for a sense of group identity and belonging have eroded, fragmented, and it's very easy to group up around just an anxiety or a prejudice. It's very easy. So you can. If you are scared about something, something doesn't seem right, something gives you high anxiety, something, or if you're someone who is not aware of your prejudices, that it's generating all these negative emotions inside you, you can go online looking for people who share those feelings, find them, and then now you're talking to them, and now you're talking to them a lot, and now you're in a community, and now it doesn't even matter how you got to the community. The facts become irrelevant. The opinions become irrelevant. All that matters is signaling over and over again that I'm a good member of this group, and belonging goals then take precedent over every other goal. And conversations almost naturally go into debate frame because you're imagining the audience, and the audience is the peers that you don't want to ostracize you. So it's as if I'm trying to have a conversation with you on Facebook. What's happening is all of a sudden we took stage, we got behind lecterns, we're imagining there's an audience watching, and we're trying to get applause and boos out of the audience because we know at the end of it there's a chance that we'll be asked to leave our groups. And that's I think what generates this behavior. The outrage part of it is mostly performative, and since you can make a lot of money by increasing engagement on your platforms, you just chase engagement. And if you chase engagement algorithmically, you just look at numbers. You don't care how you're getting the engagement. And whatever we're doing, we've twisted these knobs in this particular way. Lots of engagement came out. But inside of what's going on at the level of the people's subjective experience in the platform, those knobs may have been turned in such a way to create really terrible interactions between people. So I think that's probably where most of this is coming from.
Yeah. You were very surprised by a fellow named Charlie, who was a truther and actually the subject of a program about conspiracy theories. And the truther movement is the one that thinks that September 11 was just a staged act. Mm-hmm. Charlie was one of the leaders of this thought, and he had all these reasons for that, but he changes his mind. What happened that made him change his mind when many others haven't yet?
Yeah. So Charlie's story is similar to just about everyone I spent time with who had left either a conspiratorial group or a cult or a pseudo cult. And what in his case, he got to look at all this evidence with fellow 9/11 truthers. They even went to Ground Zero and everything, but they also met the architects of the World Trade Center. They flew a commercial airliner simulator, all sorts of stuff to learn, to just basically challenge all of their preconceived notions. And everyone there doubled down except Charlie. Charlie was like, oh, wow, this evidence is overwhelming. I've changed my mind. And he suffered tremendous social calls for that. All these things we talked about people fearing, yeah, they're real, because he was absolutely obliterated by his social group to the point that he had to kind of go into hiding and change his name. What made Charlie's story different is that he had, a couple of years earlier, had started hanging out with another group of people called the Truth Jews. And what he had discovered was that his core values, the things that he actually was looking for a community to embrace, things that the identity he was pursuing was being satisfied in that group as well. And so he had a social safety net. He had, the ability to change his mind in a way the other group didn't, because they had to suffer the complete loss of their identity, where he had another one waiting in backup. And that's one way that people get out of those groups. Another thing is you can offer that to someone who hasn't gotten it yet. That's how Megan Phelps-Roper and her story, someone from the Jewish community reached out, even though the Westboro is very anti-Semitic. Someone from that community said, I will be a empathetic, non-judgmental listener. I will offer you a space to talk. And over time, she developed this connection and this invitation for her values to be expressed outside of that community. And that was an off-ramp to get out of that world.
David McRaney has written How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. David, we want to thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio, and we wish you continued success with your podcast and with this book. Do you have any new projects you're starting?
Yeah, I'm working on just cranking up the next book, which seems unbelievable when you're in the middle of, I'm having a conversation with you about this book that came out 3 days ago. but I have another project I'm working on about genius, what that actually means, does it mean anything, and all of the problems that we've faced over the centuries when it came to trying to define that and undefine it and redefine it. So that's my next big project.
Sounds good. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. You're the best.
And that was David McRaney with How Minds Change. Fascinating book. Our next guest is National Geographic Explorer and Director of the Tree Foundation, Dr. Meg Lohman, a.k.a. Canopy Meg. She is the world's first global arbornaut, which is a treetop explorer. She'll tell us about the 2023 Nat Geo Kids Almanac. The almanac features animal stories, weird but true facts, and interviews with National Geographic explorers.
Dr. Meg Lohman, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
And I like to love the title of your show. Cool Science is really cool.
Well, and we're delighted to have you with us. And the National Geographic Explorer and Kids Almanac is for 2023 is a beautiful addition. I wanted to ask you, you are a global arbornaut, someone that is a treetop explorer. So what's it like hanging out in the canopy of these majestic trees around the world?
Well, I always tell kids it's the ultimate in cool science, so I guess that's appropriate on your show. But in all fairness, I was scared out of my wits when I first climbed a tree. I had welded a slingshot out of a piece of metal at Sydney University, where I was a scholarship student, and I sewed a harness from seatbelt webbing, and I borrowed a bunch of caving ropes, and was so curious because I wanted to see the leaves in these really tall rainforest trees, and you couldn't see them from the ground level the same way that I used to see leaves in trees where I grew up in New England of North America. So lo and behold, I climbed this tree scared to death. But when I got up there and found millions of cool things living, I overcame that fear, and it became such a passion and a joy to be up in the treetops.
It's a whole world up there. And when I was in Costa Rica, not too far from the Liberian airport, there's an inactive volcano. There was a zip line of maybe 10 or 12 zips very high up. And we were hanging out for probably 2 or 3 hours in the treetops. And there's an entire world going on up there that when you're on the ground, you don't know about it.
You know, there's something like 1% of light on the ground of a tropical forest versus 100% in the canopy. And not surprisingly, in the canopy are all the flowers and fruits, almost all the foliage in the sunlight. And so therefore, all the animals and cool critters. So it is a whole world away. And yet it's right over our heads. It's what I call hit you over the head science. I'm not some kind of genius like Einstein. I just happened to climb a tree and figure out, guess what? Half the species of the world live up there. It's only because foresters historically cut trees down. They never climbed them to do their homework. So I just happened to cross something really cool.
That is cool. And I'm wondering what year this was. You've made me curious because now it seems like you would just have a regular climbing harness and it would be sort of an easier endeavor. And yes, we have lots of canopy tours and that sort of thing. When was the first time you climbed into the canopy?
You know, and things have changed. And here's a cute little chronology, but it was the 1950s when scuba gear was invented, and that opened up the world of aquanauts and, you know, amateur divers. 1960s, we went to the moon, and then astronauts became a household word. 1980s was when I first did all this little equipment and gear, and one other guy did the same thing in Costa Rica, and suddenly it opened up the world of arbornauts. But it's so recent, relatively speaking. We had arborists that trim trees and foresters that cut trees down, but we didn't have this sector that studied the treetops because we never knew it was so different from the forest floor until about 40 years ago, which is really astounding.
That is astounding. And I'm wondering, I mean, you mentioned already the amount of light up in the canopy versus on the forest floor in these types of forests, but what else makes it really unique, I guess, that allows that makes the canopy world so much different from the floor?
Right.
Or even trees that have, you know, leaves down low.
Yeah, and the canopy is considered one of the deserts of the world too, because guess what? It pours with rain in the tropics, but the rain goes right down to the forest floor. So there are more species of cactus in the tropical canopies than there are on the desert. So there's this amazing need for species to be so resilient. They get heavy rain and then drought. They get high wind and then no wind. They get light, sunlight all the time just pounding on them. So there's this extraordinary extreme climate in many ways, but because of that sunlight, you have all of that activity of photosynthesis and growth and productivity. And it's really hard for a leaf to live in 1% light, but it's really easy to be a leaf in 100% light. So not surprisingly, all the beetles that eat leaves and all the birds that eat the beetles and all the iguanas that eat the beetles are up in the canopy. They're not down low where there wouldn't be the same food chain for them.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Meg Lohman. She's a Nat Geo Explorer and director of the Tree Foundation. And we're here speaking with her this morning about the 2023 issue of the Kids Almanac. And Dr. Lohman, I have a lot of friends that are grandparents, and I suggest the almanac to every one of them, because what a great tool that is, and pictures and everything. Why don't, for those folks that have not seen a Nat Geo almanac for kids, describe it.
Sure. I mean, I think it's like the whole magazine all consolidated into one issue if you wanted to take 2 years worth of articles. But it's this fabulous, almost 300 pages worth of amazing photos, amazing stories, amazing facts with a grandkid or even as an adult. Secretly, you could just page through it, and every time you turn a page, you'll have something new. For me, I'm particularly excited that they've taken trees seriously this year. I think a lot of people take trees for granted as some quiet denizen of the planet. They don't speak like chimpanzees or dolphins or have that charisma, but they do keep us alive. So trees are this year the theme for the National Geographic Challenge activities for the kids. So I think everyone will enjoy it. And hopefully everyone has seen a tree in his life, whereas not everyone has seen a chimpanzee or a dolphin.
Yeah, exactly. Lynn and I were speaking with a guest several weeks ago who told us this fascinating story about a really thick canopy in Bolivia where there was hardly any sunlight getting through. And they had this airplane and they put LIDAR on it, which is a type of sensing radar that they use with, among other things, autonomous cars. But anyway, they just ran this thing back and forth like a lawnmower over this giant swath of land. And it just found these little open areas where LIDAR could get through. And it ended up discovering, being responsible for discovering the lost monkey god, some crazy thing in Bolivia. Have you heard about that?
I have, you know, and LIDAR is a fabulous tool, as are drones for doing aerial surveying. And in the case of LIDAR, they can detect soil types and anthropological relics, which is, I think, what you're talking about. The one thing I always point out and kind of chuckle is we still need tree climbers. Despite the greatness of LIDAR, we still can't figure out which beetle is eating which orchid or which pollinator is pollinating which tree. So we need the combination of LIDAR for that level of technology for the discovery you just talked about, but we also need that basic tree climbing kit to go up there and collect the specimen and take a picture of it. So both old and new technologies are very important in the world of National Geographic discovery.
You know, you have been called a few really choice things. I wish that I had been called some of the things that you've been called, but things like the real life Lorax and the Einstein of the treetops. And this is by National Geographic and by the Wall Street Journal. And you really pioneered this science of canopy ecology. And while you're very humble, I can tell, and you're very low key, I'm just kind of wondering how this developed. I mean, you first went up into the canopy in the 80s, and then you found all of this incredible world. And I'm wondering, as soon as you mentioned orchids, it made me want to ask that question, you know, what is the most wild thing that you have seen that surprised you that you really would have had no idea existed?
I guess two things I'm going to mention. One is kind of crazy and wonderful, but the most amazing thing that I've seen in the canopy is the commonest thing that lives in the trees of Utah and Mexico. Do you know what it is?
No.
Quiz.
I wanted to say a sloth because I really want to see sloths, but I know they don't exist in Utah.
They're probably not the commonest, but this is wild and kids love this, but it's probably water bears, which are microscopic. So I have to qualify that, but I didn't know much about them, but I did have one of the first grants from the federal government to take disabled kids, kids that have mobility limitations that are in wheelchairs, to teach them to climb trees. And I had to think, what could they discover that would make them feel important? And so therefore I couldn't pick sloths because we've already discovered them, and I couldn't pick birds because we've already discovered all of them in North America. So we went and searched for water bears, and they found all these new species. And then kids started writing me. They're like, we love water bears. They're so extreme. They've been to the moon. They've reproduced in outer space. They're found everywhere. We estimate there's like 5,000 or maybe more in every tree. So suddenly they hit the map as this cool, they're so cute. They're just like darling little microscopic things. So that's just one element of extreme animal. But if I had to pick something you could see, I'm going to go with you, Lynn. I love the sloth and I love the koala, and I've been in the tree with them. They're not frightened of me when I climb because they don't know a human enemy in the canopy. So I could pet a koala. It's amazing. I could get right up close and watch it munch the leaves. And I wish you were with me, Lynn, but maybe we'll do that someday.
That would be something very special. Well, and the other reason, I suppose, that they didn't feel threatened by you is because they're threatened by predators on the ground.
Correct.
I think that's probably when koalas and sloths move as fast as they've ever moved before, is when they have to come down for, I don't know what.
Well, I know what. You know, I had a student that studied, why do sloths only poop on the ground? I won't tell you the answer that. You'll have to go on my website and look it up.
Oh, we will. We will. What does it take to become a National Geographic explorer?
A couple things, I think. One is, of course, I've applied to them for funding for some of my crazy and innovative research. And I think Nat Geo is one of the few funding sources in science that doesn't want you to be conventional. They don't require you to have some huge and boring data set. They're okay with you asking some wild question about some place that nobody's ever been, like the forest canopy. And then once I produced good results and obviously had made discoveries and exhibited curiosity, I can qualify as an explorer, so to speak. So really just curious scientists or curious ecologists or even curious anthropologists, I think they are that one group in the world that loves to collect, you know, people who are out to discover the undiscovered. And I'm really honored to be one of the pioneers of what we call the eighth continent, meaning the forest canopy, because I'm not a kid that came from some privileged background. I just grew up in the most ordinary way, but it reminds kids everywhere, I think, when I meet them and tell them, you know, I didn't have any real advantage. I just asked a lot of questions and was curious. And that's a good lesson for every kid, I hope.
Asking a lot of questions is. And speaking of that, what one question do you have about tree canopies that's not been answered yet?
Oh my gosh, I'm glad you asked. No one's ever almost asked me that in an interview. How many species live in a cubic meter of treetop? Can you believe we have no technologies? We have zillions of dollars going to medical research, and so we should. We have zillions of dollars going to outer space research, but we have very limited research on biodiversity on Earth. And I still feel like some engineer out there could invent a zapper or something that could tell me the canopy has this many species. Here's where the density is highest. Here's where it's lowest. We have a lot of guesswork as climbers and ecologists, but we don't have the real facts. And if we knew that, then we could home in on those areas that were so precious and sample them first and foremost.
Well, I'm gonna send your request on, or your questions on, to a friend of mine. Dr. Compton Tucker is responsible for remote sensing for NASA, and he has a constellation of satellites that he's looking at all sorts of different things, trying to understand how photosynthesis changes from season to season and those sorts of, I don't know if they can take the granularity that you're talking about, but I'm going to mention it to him because he's in charge of remote sensing and maybe he has some thoughts on that.
And you please do that and tell him hi for me, because I actually had him speak at a Canopy conference years ago because of his expertise. So he'll probably remember Canopy Meg, and you readdress that question to him.
Oh, I will. And Compton Tucker's a good guy. I'm sure he'll have some thoughts on this matter.
Well, Meg, your enthusiasm is palpable and infectious, which is so wonderful. And it's why you're such a great spokesperson, especially for the Kids Almanac. And I wanted to ask you, I'm really curious about the medicinal plants. We have recently done a couple of interviews on medicinal plants, and I once saw a documentary about the acai tree and how they harvest from the berries from way up high, and I wondered about that whole world.
Absolutely, it's fantastic, and that's really the reason why my last big project, which is the last chapter of my new book called The Arbornaut, is called Mission Green, where I want to save the 10 most endangered genetic libraries on Earth, which are those countries that don't have the funding to save their own forests, such as Ethiopia and Madagascar, because they're all apothecaries. They're all this amazing area of medicines as well as of species. So it's really, really important. And a lot of times people think, oh, all the medicines are from the Amazon, but there's a tree in Ethiopia that I work with that has a cure for prostate cancer. And every country has its own drugstore in the canopy. And we need to work with that so desperately. We need to be respectful of saving that, what I call genetic library. So I'm glad you brought up medicines, because it's also a great way to link with local people. And I always tell students, the only way to really get good research done is to build up trust with local people and learning about their medicines, learning how they use the trees, sharing our knowledge of the trees is something that we both can respect, the indigenous people as well as the Western scientists, because we have to be very humble when we work in these precious places that belong to someone else.
Very slowly, slowly, our world seems to be becoming more aware of the dangers of plastics. We have a plastic bag ban in our little town, which is great. And I, you know, recently in Mexico noticed that there's a growing awareness. I'm seeing a lot less single-use plastic. Even a town near here banned plastic bags, which is just amazing, because it didn't seem that there was ever going to be that level of awareness. So hopefully this is a ball that will snowball. Can you talk to us a little bit about plastics?
Absolutely. And the Almanac has a really good section on that. So I encourage every parent and child to study that section. 250 pieces of plastic per human being exist out in that Pacific Ocean gyre, which is plastic litter. So it's really, really important. But here's another amazing thing. I just taught a class, a college class called Sustainable Fashion. Who would know, but polyester and rayon spew all this plastic through washing your clothes. We've got to get the sports industry involved. I look around at every golf shirt and every basketball shirt being made out of these synthetic fabrics that is spewing plastic. So we not only need to work on plastic bags, but we need to work on what we wear, and we need to work on what we buy, as far as everything from upholstery to, you know, rugs and everything else. So it's a huge industry. It's controllable and our kids are aware of it, but I worry that we are really putting toxins into things like the water supply and even the air. So I'm glad you brought that up, but it's just not easy to control it, is it?
No, it's not. And Lynn and I have had so many conversations lately with people that are huge fans of trees. And now that we find out there's that you're doing all this studying in the canopy and what you're learning, and there's all this studying that's being done below the surface as they look at the mycelium and they're looking at the possible networking of trees and organisms. That's all tied together, isn't it?
Absolutely. And actually in the 1980s, I did a lot of work on that underground stuff. We piloted that in Australia before anybody had even thought about it. And guess what? We found out that certain species, including eucalypts, including a couple of rainforest trees, were competitive. They were out-competing their neighbors because they had the relationships with the mycorrhizae, as they're called, and we were able to put that all together. It was actually one of my most best-selling publications in science. You know, they rank these kind of crazy things. But, and now I've done the same thing in the canopy, where there are scientists who have studied the communication that leaves emit some chemical messages when insects start to bite them, and it shares it with their neighbors. So they say, quick, create chemicals so the insects won't come and bite you too. So there's extraordinary communication in the root systems as well as in the leaf systems. It's pretty cool.
And is the mycelium, does that come from the trees or does that come from the mushroom community?
No, it comes from the mushroom community, but only certain species of trees are conducive to having that relationship. So there are certain special kind of mycorrhizae, as the mycelium are called, that are conducive to almost like mating with one tree, with joining forces with certain species of trees. And not all species of trees have that conducivity. But then there are also a couple different types of these mycorrhizae that join with different trees and not always the same trees. It's an amazingly complex community underneath the ground, which is very, very...
I guess my question is what are you headed towards next? And what are you most hopeful about as you look into the future?
Well, first of all, I have to be hopeful because I have two boys and now I have two grandchildren, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, we can't lose hope. And as adults, it's easy to be negative Nellies all the time. And so based on that, I'm thinking, what do I do with 45 years of studying canopies around the world, knowing local people with a lot of trust, having a big network of scientists? Do I retire and go out on a sailboat? Do I sit back on my Social Security and do nothing? But the answer is, of course, no. I need to say, how do I help the forests that need the most help? And that's why I did mention earlier my new book called The Arbornaut, which is a memoir about the challenges of women in science. But more to the point, the last chapter is really about this new program I launched called Mission Green. A friend of mine named Sylvia Earle is an oceanographer, and she has Mission Blue to identify hope spots in the ocean. So I've started Mission Green, and that is to identify the hot spots in the canopy where those medicines and species are so abundant, but the country can't afford to save them. And so we've had a big success. We built a walkway in Malaysia and another one in the Amazon. And those walkways in turn hire local women and families for ecotourism instead of logging as an income. And then they create this aura of thrill and excitement for visitors to learn about the canopy. And in turn, they become genetic libraries to house these medicines and species until the countries can afford to save broader tracts of forest. So I'm very excited about that. We're fundraising now for Madagascar. We're about halfway through our budget of $1 million. We've raised 500,000. We want to do Mozambique next, and then India and Bhutan. But these are countries where it's easy to overlook and say, oh, we just need to save the forests in our own backyard, but we really don't. And you probably understand that, Lynn, because you learned about medicinal plants. Those medicines are all over the world. They're not only our local trees. So we need to view one planet. And I think kids understand that better than their parents sometimes. So that's my goal, is 10 forests, 10 genetic libraries, and then I can go with the earthworms to the grave.
Dr. Meg Lohman, she's National Geographic Explorer, Director of the Tree Foundation. She is the world's first global arbornaut, someone that is a treetop explorer in the canopy of the trees.
And we hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Meg Lohman. She is the most amazing woman and so excited about what she does. I put her in a classification along with people like Jane Goodall and Temple Grandin, both of whom have endorsed her new book. She mentioned it a couple times during the interview, The Arbornaut, A Life Discovering the Eighth Continent in the Trees Above Us. And think about this for a moment on one of those hot summer afternoons when the kids just want to be inside where it's cool. Look up a YouTube of Meg Lohman as she is exploring the canopy, and you'll just see a world out there, especially if, you know, at some point in your lives, you're doing a canopy tour in Latin America or somewhere like that. So what a great opportunity to learn, and especially for our young women out there who are interested in science, following people like Jane Goodall, like Meg Lohman, like Temple Grandin, is a wonderfully enriching opportunity. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.